Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. I'm your host, Sam Notla. Last time, we talked about the mental health of prisoners and the extent, or rather lack thereof, of mental health treatment in prisons. What we found was that prisons were constantly underdiagnosing mental health problems or marking previously diagnosed ones as resolved. What that means is someone could have been diagnosed with something like schizophrenia or depression, but once they were actually in prison and they had to be treated for such, prison psychologists or staff just said, oh no, they don't have it anymore, when they clearly still did. Most analyses of this situation have noted that this is due to a lack of resources, which could be due to several factors. A 2014 policy change meant to give prisoners more mental health treatment actually backfired. The reason for that is that the 2014 policy stipulated that we need to increase treatment for prisoners, but it didn't allocate any funding to that regard. And as a result, prisons knowingly downgraded the mental care of many prisoners as they just didn't have the resources to deal with these increased requirements with the numbers that they were currently seeing. However, this could also be explained by the fact that prisons spend a paltry amount on mental health care to begin with, which makes even these more reasonable requirements unmeetable when they shouldn't be. We also talked about how studies have shown that the prison environment actually creates mental health problems wholesale in previously healthy individuals. If I remember correctly, they found that they actually had a high incidence of PTSD developing in individuals in prison, a lot of them, even if they didn't face personal trauma, by being exposed to the trauma of so many other mistreated prisoners, had actually developed their own PTSD as well. We then went into some personal stories of prisoners with mental health issues, including one that resulted in a lawsuit against the Illinois Department of Corrections, or IDOC, alleging that they were punishing prisoners with mental illness instead of treating them. This lawsuit actually took 9 whole years to be settled in favor of the prisoners, and even after it was settled, a year or two later, a federal monitor found that IDOC wasn't holding up its end of the bargain, and they're quoted as saying that mental care was grossly insufficient and extremely poor in quality. You know, these are like official words. Finally, that time, we ended by talking about how some treatment centers that have popped up recently, these treatment centers for mentally ill prisoners have had a huge positive impact, although even despite that, their reach is still unfortunately far too narrow, considering the large population that needs their help. Today we're going to talk about something that you guys have probably been hearing nonstop for the past few weeks, or if you were a more forward-looking individual, or just way smarter, the past few months. So today we're going to talk about COVID-19, or coronavirus, and how it's been affecting prisoners. If you remember our episode that touched on prison healthcare, you can probably see how this is a huge problem. You have a lack of healthcare personnel, and particularly a lack of qualified and good healthcare personnel, which really plagues our prison system. And what I mean by that is not only is there a shortage of doctors and nurses and staff to treat prisoners, but a lot of the staff that are there are embroiled in a bunch of controversy. Like we talked about how there were a bunch that were found to have been criminally negligent, yet continued to be able to practice in the same prisons in which they effectively killed prisoners. That's already a huge problem, and that kind of underlies a lot of these other issues. In the face of a global pandemic, these things are a recipe for disaster. This is actually such a broad-reaching issue that there's no way for me to cover everything, but I'll hit some key points that I think are most worth bringing up. So without further ado, let's get into it. So to start with, let's see what ordinary people are able to do to fight the spread of coronavirus, right? They're self-quarantining. If you show the symptoms or have been in contact with somebody who's shown the symptoms, if you don't or you haven't been in contact with such a person, you should probably still stay home in order to further prevent the spread and in order so that you don't get it yourself. And there's also social distancing, where you can avoid meeting up in groups and also try to keep a 6-foot distance between you and the next individual wherever you go in public. As a caveat, I just want to know right now that even now there are still millions of Americans who don't have this luxury anyways. You have grocery workers, people living paycheck to paycheck, people whose employers refuse to shut down despite being shelter in place, and probably people in a bunch of other categories. But I just want to let you know the things that are being recommended for most people. Well, the issue with all of these things is that prisoners can't really do any of these. According to McDowell and Mason in the Washington Post, I think health experts sum it up best. Their quote is saying that prisons are little cities hidden behind tall fences where many people share cells, sit elbow to elbow at dining areas, and are herded through halls to the yard or prison industry jobs. A prisoner can't realistically self-quarantine or practice social distancing because the physical reality makes it impossible. In New York, for example, some prisons report having 29 prisoners share the same toilet while having dorm-style sleeping quarters that shove large groups of people into a small area. An area so small that each prisoner could just reach out with their arm and touch the next bed over, as they said. Prisons in general just aren't exactly known for being spacious areas, and in a prison system that currently incarcerates over 2.2 million people, the problem just gets worse. Even simple measures like hand washing are difficult to enact, especially when prisoners are reporting huge shortages of simple goods like soap and toilet paper. Like, everyone's heard of or has experienced all these shortages firsthand, right? Like, you go to your local market and you find that all the toilet paper's already been bought up. That's been reported on a lot of levels. Now, imagine somewhere like a prison where it's not exactly like you're a huge priority, and it's not like they have the ability to go out and buy themselves. They just have to rely on getting it shipped in. Hand sanitizer is actually banned from prisons as well due to its alcohol content. Prisoners, and I mean just people in general, have spoken up a lot about it, especially in the wake of this crisis. Like, it's pretty crazy to assume that they're going to be drinking hand sanitizer for its alcohol content when there's a pandemic going on. So here, what you essentially have is you have a situation where prisoners are powerless to really take their fate into their own hands, as they're physically unable to follow many of the guidelines that people on the outside are being told to. But it really doesn't end there, because even then you could say something like, well, it shouldn't really get there in the first place because the prison system is contained, right? And what that means is, well, how would they get coronavirus if, you have all these prisoners in the same area? Like, where's it going to come from? But correctional officers, staff, and civilian employees can come and go with much greater ease. And furthermore, no one can really guarantee that these people are following the guidelines at home in the first place. And then you could say, all right, well, as long as we have a bunch of testing and stuff like that going on, then it should still be okay, because, they'll get tested before they come in and everything. But we have insanely low test rates in the U.S. right now. And with test rates being as low as they are, even healthy-looking individuals could be carriers of the deadly virus, with around, I think, I saw 50 to 60% of individuals being asymptomatic. The actual percentage itself probably isn't too big of a worry, whether it's like 50 or 40%. The point there is just that there's a huge population of individuals that get the virus that are just asymptomatic or that are asymptomatic for a long time while they're spreading it and then who develop symptoms later on. So now, not only do prisoners not have the ability to slow the spread of the virus, but their fate is wholly out of their hands, as they have to hope that none of the correctional officers or staff get it as well. And if they do get it and spread it to prisoners, it's going to spread like wildfire. That whole self-contained system thing is a recipe for disaster. When you have everyone in these small corners and you introduce this infection, and no one can distance themselves, they'll spread it from person to person. And when we consider that most confirmed cases in prisons and jails have been in officers, staff, and civilian employees, there's a good reason to be worried if you're a prisoner. Now, let's go back to what I said about the quarantine for a second. Physically, it's not really possible to quarantine or social distance the prison population on a large scale. But I wasn't completely right on that, completely accurate to start with. Some prisoners are being quarantined. But the only way that that's really being done right now is pretty barbaric, as people are being thrown into solitary confinement, which is a punishment that's notoriously brutal both to the physical and mental health of people who are subject to it. So not only would your condition get even worse if you got the virus, but your mental state would start to degrade as well. Without the ability to really do anything to stop or slow the spread, you'd basically be brutally punished for something you had no control over, Imagine getting thrown into solitary because a correctional officer or staff member brought it into prison. Imagine that you'd done literally nothing wrong, but you were being subjected to such a cruel fate nevertheless. It's just another injustice on top of the many systematic ones that are inherent to our prison system. And that's the reality that many prisoners are facing during this global health crisis, And with over 300 confirmed cases in correctional facilities so far, the problem's only going to get worse, and it's going to get worse very quickly. Prisons aren't particularly cleanly either, which adds even further to the crisis that prisoners are facing and will continue to face. Michael Mendoza, the national director of Cut 50, represents a movement that aims to cut crime and incarceration in the United States. He has personal experience with the prison system, and he knows that every prison that he'd visited between the levels of 2 and 5 on a federal level had poor health and hygiene standards. And so even then, let's say that prisons do take the proper approach of temporarily lowering their personnel and minimizing the amount of contact between prison staff and correctional officers and prisoners. Well, the problem then on the hygiene front is that, you know, hygiene's going to get even worse. You know, you have less people to clean and take care of facilities. So, you know, as you can see, the more you look at the conditions of prisons and their potential to just spread the virus without just talking about like how bad the virus is going to get in terms of impact, the worse of a situation that you end up with. In almost every aspect, prisons are ill-suited to deal with the virus, you know, from healthcare to hygiene to distancing standards to isolation and more. And as I've been harping on this whole time, what that means is that this situation can get bad really fast. And so let's talk a bit about the impact. You know, for many prisoners, getting the virus would be bad enough. Even if it doesn't kill young or middle-aged individuals, younger middle-aged individuals at an extremely high rate, with the average or median prisoner being in their 30s, per the Bureau of Prisons, there's still a slew of awful symptoms and long-lasting complications that come with it. It's been shown to cause severe lung damage, for example, in even otherwise healthy individuals who are going to have to bear with that damage for the rest of their lives. These aren't elderly or immunocompromised patients I'm talking about. They're people who are outside of elevated risk groups, you know, the people that would be in their 30s or 40s. But that being said, we should also realize that there are a substantial amount of elderly and immunocompromised prisoners who are particularly at risk of not only catching the virus and becoming symptomatic, but of dying as a result. You know, that's probably the worst symptom you can get there. For example, you have 2.8% of prisoners that are over 65, and at 2.2 million prisoners, like overall in the US, that's nearly 62,000 people who are at risk of dying solely based on their age. You know, if we're saying over 65 is elderly, which I think most people are when they talk about these stats and risk groups for coronavirus. And this is in an environment that could spread it at the drop of a dime, you know, in the prison. But we should also note that given the horrendous state of healthcare behind bars, many have found that being over 50 in prison is actually similar to being over 65 on the outside. According to an Al Jazeera article, there's a doctor quoted as saying that the average prisoner has 3 or 4 continuing health risks and can be on up to 7 medications by the age of 50. You know, if we were to add this population, that's a whopping additional 16.7% of all prisoners, or 368,000 people who are at the worst risk just based on age. I couldn't find any hard statistics on immunocompromised individuals, on the other hand, so what I did was I looked for stuff about HIV, because that's like the most common immunocompromising disease, I think just in general, but especially in prisons where it's at 3 times the rate of the general population. So that being said, I found one stat about prisoners with HIV who'd be immunocompromised. Per the Bureau of Justice, the seroprevalence, or prevalence in blood serum, of HIV is 1.5% for incarcerated individuals, which is roughly another 33,000 people who are at a similar risk. And we should also just add individuals with lung problems in general, you know, like those who have asthma, because as we said earlier, this virus causes severe lung damage even in completely healthy individuals. So it's specifically causing lung damage is, you know, it's reason to worry if you're someone with lung problems, especially with something like asthma being so common and widespread as it is. And even without a medical syndrome, 65% of state prisoners were smokers as of 2016, as were 45% of federal prisoners. You know, so that's some obvious lung damage there. So what this is to say is that for someone who already has lung damage, the outcome can be particularly grim. And this is all to say that even if you're healthy, this thing can cause some serious damage. And if you're not, which, as we talked about, is a huge portion of incarcerated individuals, you're at a very real risk of lifelong damage or even death. There is some good news that's come out of this, though, although I'm hesitant to call it good news given the context that it's in. And that's the crisis has pushed for the release of many at-risk individuals and low-level individuals. As such, what happened was you had lawmakers and civil rights advocates applying an extraordinary amount of pressure that they've gotten it to be enacted even on a federal level. You know, because of their efforts, you actually had Attorney General William Barr, who told federal prisons to identify elderly and immunocompromised individuals who can be sent to home confinement instead of having to stay in prison. On the other hand, we should also recognize that federal prisoners only number 170,000. Which is a huge number, but an extremely small portion of the 2.2 million that we cited earlier. So this is the first step that we should be taking, but there's clearly much more that needs to be done on this front. Many individual facilities have actually taken to releasing multiple low-level offenders in order to combat this problem. For example, in New York, 200 prisoners were released last Thursday, per the Al Jazeera article, with another 175 being scheduled for release later on. This would actually bring incarceration levels down to their lowest levels since before World War II, which kind of puts our incarceration system into a pretty crazy perspective. But even then, many know and say that this still isn't even close to enough. After all, in the same state prison system, 58 Department of Corrections employees and 73 inmates have already tested positive. This situation has actually even caused those on the Board of Correction itself urging for a release of even more inmates, far beyond the numbers that were already released. For example, there are 1,000 low-level prisoners in New York just at Rikers Island. These are people who are in there for things like parole violations. Other states like New Jersey and California have also released record amounts of inmates. In New Jersey, for example, there was a big agreement between four groups, which were the New Jersey ACLU, the Public Defender's Office, the State Attorney General's Office, and the County Prosecutors Association. That led to 800 low-level prisoners being slated for release. In California, in Los Angeles alone, that number is 1,700, which, again, these are huge numbers of people being released in the wake of this virus. Now, we've talked a lot about the physical problems associated with the crisis, but that's not the only kind. So this is getting away from the good news and back to the bad news, unfortunately. And so this is an issue with more regard to mental health, which is, in the context of the past episode, is even more relevant now. And that's that many prisons have suspended visits by friends and family members, and federal ones have suspended them everywhere for 30 days. And it's a good thing that they're slowing the spread, virus and everything, but we should think about the kind of mental impact that it has as well. And so what happened is that at this time, communication with loved ones is paramount to the mental health of prisoners, right? For multiple reasons. Prisoners fear for the health of their family members as they're often unable to get news on how they would be coping on the outside. Family members, in turn, would be similarly worried about their incarcerated relatives. In addition to that, simply being cut off from your loved ones is a significant mental blow in and of itself. We have a litany of evidence that shows that stress negatively affects the immune system, and this situation essentially blows up mental health and turns that into a physical problem as well. So to combat this a bit, some prisons have begun to institute policies of free phone calls, which gives prisoners some degree of communication during this trying time. The Marshall Project has actually been quick to move on reporting this communication issue in particular. They say that while there are free calls in some facilities, even these are of limited number, and families still have to pay for the extra time. So it's not like, oh, okay, we're going to make all calls free, and so this communication problem won't be an issue. In federal prisons, for example, they say that there are 200 extra minutes per month being offered, but they can cost up to 21 cents a minute. If you remember how low prison wages were from previous episodes, you'll remember that they can be below $1 an hour, and you can see how exorbitant of a price that essentially is. Like, let's do some quick math, right? Like, let's say you make $1 per hour, and this thing costs about 21 cents a minute. Basically, per an hour of wage, you get 5 minutes on a phone. And that's if you spent your entire wage on that. There's like a bunch of other things that you'd want to do. Unfortunately, as we talked about in, I think it might have been our first episode, or one of our earlier episodes, prisoners are being charged to read things on ebooks, So imagine having to make a decision between, well, do I buy like 30 minutes of reading time or 5 minutes with someone that I care about during this whole crisis? It's a crazy thing to have to ask someone to pick between. And even if families aren't requesting direct communication, they're finding it difficult to get any kind of status update from prison officials on their incarcerated loved ones. Like, let's not even take into account if you just wanted to know the status of a random prisoner that you have a connect that you have a personal connection to. Even hospitalized prisoners are finding it difficult to get in contact with family members, and family members are finding it similarly difficult to find out information about them. They note that prison medical staff rarely return calls about hospitalized prisoners, and when they actually do pick up, they're often just shuffled from one voicemail box to another. So just imagine that for a second. Like, you know that your loved one is in prison and they've contracted something. You might not even know if it's coronavirus for sure. You know that's bad enough that they've had to be hospitalized with it. And so in this whole crisis, with all the stress that you have to deal with just from your everyday life, you just don't know what's going on the inside. You know that stuff is bad, but you don't have any other information past that. And what that means is that even on the communication front, our prison system is doing poorly during this crisis. So basically what's happened through all this is the crisis really highlighted just how poorly our prison system is set up to take care of the incarcerated. You can talk about each individual issue for days, when we don't have a crisis like this, but something like this kind of shows you, when push comes to shove, every element of the system plays against those on the inside. The odds are basically stacked against them just whenever something like this happens. The one silver lining is that we're having the early release of a lot of low-level prisoners, but it's a small recompense considering the situation at hand. Prisoners don't have the luxury of being able to follow the same guidelines that we can and are forced to have their fate in the hands of others who they have to hope are following the proper precautions. And even then, like let's say you have 90% of people who are following the proper precautions, in such a system, it only takes one infected individual to start an epidemic that'll spread throughout the entire prison. In such a stressful time, then, they're even constantly denied communication with their loved ones, which erodes their mental health even further. The measures that prisons do take to quarantine are monstrous, punishing prisoners for someone else's sin in the case of something like solitary. With 2.2 million incarcerated individuals, we have a huge population that essentially just has to sit there and wait and hope that they aren't the unlucky ones, that they're not the prison that gets the virus and gets it spreading. And a lot of that fear is probably also the fact that with this reduced testing and the high asymptomatic rate, it could be that it's already spread throughout the entire prison. Like everyone might already have it, or a large population might already have it. They just don't know. And what that means is that when it does hit, it's gonna get bad really quickly when all these asymptomatic people, suddenly start showing symptoms. We'll stop here for now on the show. There's probably a lot more to look into, but the situation is rapidly developing, so there's sure to be more news on this front and much more quality news and soon. Right now, a lot of reporting I think is pretty rushed and not super comprehensive, and the reason is, well, you know why a lot of reporting on this issue right now is rushed, not super comprehensive. It's because it's a whole global health pandemic. And so I can only hope that we take a more proactive stance in the future. For a lot of activist groups, now is the time to put pressure on prison officials to do so. But unfortunately, this is a kind of environment where you can't really go out there and put pressure, like in person or anything. So, there's a little catch-22 there. But it is relevant, to put this pressure on them because this issue is going to get worse and fast. Especially at a time where, if you look at infection rates right now in the US, they're still increasing at a linear rate on the log scale, which means that this thing is still growing exponentially. It hasn't shown any signs of being stamped out or the curve being flattened by any of the measures that we've taken so far. So, really, it's just going to get a lot worse for everyone right now, and for people in prisons, it's going to get particularly bad, for people that are at risk. But anyways, with that having been said and ending on kind of a gloomy note, thanks for everyone who listened, and I hope that you're all safe as well. Be sure to practice all the, social distancing and self-quarantining techniques that you've been hearing about every day. This is a serious issue, and it's good to be able to do something while you can. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, feel free to email me at prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. I'll respond to anything you guys have to say. One thing that I do want to note is that I'm usually not an expert on any of these topics, but I do know a lot of people who are experts or have connection to experts. So even if you have a question that you think is pretty esoteric or anything, you can feel free to email me and I'll try to link you up with someone who knows more than me if I don't know about it at the moment. But that being said, I'll talk to you next.